Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Reasoning with an Optimist podcast for the week of March 13th, 2016. This is Jack Brissett Mills. I have a conversation with Alicia today, perhaps my newest friend. But first, the verses from Rudolf Steiner's Calendar of the Soul for his week 50. This one I wrote 2 years ago for that verse. Verse 50. This amazing joy of the earth to grow and renew and start again has reached into me, and I am humbled to discover that all along it has wished to see out through my eyes. And this one I wrote last year for the same Rudolf Steiner verse. 50A. The joy of spring, blind and mute in the earth, rises through me in mighty song. The tune is one of liberation, singing that I, by my consciousness, am its greatest creation. Alicia, I met her through a friend of a friend, and we talked on Valentine's Day. So nice. So nice. Thank you, Alicia. Enjoy, everyone.
Urban farmer and a teacher. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Urban farmer. I love that. That's the best act of rebellion anybody can do, I think.
Yes.
So, solutions. Yeah. I only heard recently, and of course it's obvious, the word solution has the word Sol, S-O-L, which is our sun. That's the name of our sun.
So to bring light to the situation.
There you are.
The warm heart to warm situation. That's lovely. So I, a few years ago, learned the term solutionary, which I think was powerful for me.
Solutionary.
And it was, I believe I'll give credit to the woman who does the story of Stuff. Do you know that?
It's a podcast.
It's a little video series.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, I saw that maybe 4 years ago. I saw that. That was very good.
Yeah, it's pretty old, but she's the one who coined that term.
Nice. And so solutionary means if I come up with a certain kind of idea, it really solves a lot of things. It's solutionary.
Yes, that. And then just to come to a situation with that goal of bringing light, of bringing warmth, right, to illuminate a situation and to almost, you know, like the sun reaches every corner of a room, that nothing is left uncovered or not looked at until a solution or until understanding finds its way.
So maybe a person can be solutionary as they show up.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that I understand, I guess for some reason, one of her intents was to put that word against revolutionary. You know, I mean, that's a word that we use frequently with urban farming, and now Bernie's using the word revolution. Yeah. And it's, I mean, I really like it, and I'm drawn to, like, say, yeah, like, fight. But really, is that the solution? You know, like, pounding my idea into someone else's head, when really the solution is, like, to take a breath, to be like the sun, to bring warmth, to bring light, and listen, right? What you just said. It's, like, to listen
better.
To what's there.
Much better.
Yeah, and to find that solution with smiles on our faces rather than somebody bleeding.
I was talking recently about this. I read, or at least I have read, a lot of Rudolf Steiner. He was this thinker from 1900s.
So let me interrupt just for a minute so I can tell you that we're on the same page with this. I was really excited yesterday to hear you bring him up, because the farmer that I learned from in Indiana is a biodynamic farmer. So I know a lot of Rudolf Steiner, and he's one of my heroes as well. So now I'll listen as long as you know that we have come from the same place.
He gave an idea of moral imagination, and that's probably exactly what you're talking about. A person doesn't have morality because he follows the orders of a sect or a religion. He has morality simply because he's imaginative, she's imaginative, and thinks of solutions to problems from themselves. So they have a large toolbox to choose the right method to help in situations. And they have morality because they're a free person. They're an independent, free person. And apparently his idea is that if we are truly free people, we are moral. We have morality in us as mm-hmm. a basic human thing. We don't have to be told to be good. We are good when we are free, when we're truly free in our thinking and our will. And so I suppose that's what solutionary is. He would have said, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, farming, of course, answers every problem. Whenever I'm depressed, I need to have an activity. What kind of activity? Well, a physical activity. What kind of physical activity? Well, one that things are growing.
The sun is hitting your face.
Yeah. It solves all the problems.
It's just so simple. That's just like simple. And that simpleness doesn't, it's not satisfying in a lot of ways. Like, we just have to look past it. Oh, it couldn't be that simple.
Right.
It couldn't be.
Right.
But it is. And, you know, anytime I talk to a person, it always comes around to food. It always comes around to growing food, whether or not I bring it up.
Yep.
But it's just like such a place to connect with another person.
Yeah.
To find something to do, something in common. Yeah. And it's food. I didn't need it.
And we're constantly, what do we do in our day that is not related to eating or buying what we're going to eat? Or cleaning up after we've eaten, or then the amount of time spent in the toilet evacuating what we've eaten. You know, it's our, what is our day?
That's true.
What is
it's
our day?
It's pretty simple.
It's just most of our day is that. And of course it has to be. My friend Owen was just talking about a book called Gut, and they make a play on gut feeling, of course, but the idea that the gut is one of our most important and intelligent organs. Calling it an organ, of course, doesn't mean anything. It's the whole gut. It's several organs.
Right.
And that
right.
its activity and its health or illness makes us be depressed or makes us be happy. That we think we make ourselves happy by our thinking, or our mood is based on our ideas, but no, the gut. And what is that again? It's the right food. You can't have Twinkies for lunch and candy bars for dinner and then have a good mood. You're going to be messed up.
Yeah. So searching for solution around food, I know where to start, right? It's by doing it. But I think even like beyond. So when I think about solution, that's what I think of it like almost like 3D, that it's not something you talk about or something that you just do, but there's like layers to it.
Yes.
So we could talk about solution is food and grow some food, and that would be the solution. But like, I oftentimes like think about looking behind it or turning my head sideways. And really, I think the block that we have is, so food is dangerous, right? Food is dangerous now, and it didn't used to be dangerous. I'm going to turn 50 this year. So when I grew up, my mom had a garden and, you know, she grew food and canned food and whatever she didn't grow. We went to the grocery store and she bought whatever was cheap, and we would go here because the bread was on sale, or the, you know, we didn't have to think about, oh, this bread is dangerous, or,
yes,
oh, you know, this corn is dangerous, or whatever cereal has poison in it. It wasn't like that. So, I guess what I'm really, since I'm kind of in a generation between the two, I feel that people of my mom's generation, or people maybe who aren't quite as knowing yet as I am, maybe they have, like, for me to push too hard and push organic too hard almost insults them. And I don't know if you, because I'm a mother, I'm a woman, I feel that that's the first block someone will put up, is that they feel that we are judging the way they raised their kids, or we are judging the food that they fed their kids. Yeah. I'm not judging the food my mom fed me. It was good home-cooked food, and it was safe food, relatively safe food. But now to continue that same habit, it's a dangerous thing to do. And it's so, I guess that's making any sense at all.
No, what you are saying is natural human thing that when you have been doing something a certain way, I'll mention this thing called rethink. There was a movement called rethink, which never quite caught on, but there were several gatherings, rethink gatherings, and I always wanted to go to them.
Okay.
The idea, it's very similar to Steiner's ideas. If you pick up Steiner's ideas, or if you go to these rethink places, you have a terrible burden that you must admit that you haven't been right. There's been something wrong with how you have been. And that's a huge burden. If you do it yourself, if you find the brochure yourself, and then you say, hey, this is interesting, and then you go to it yourself, it's much easier to change because you found it. But if your friend or if your spouse tells you, you have a problem because you have to admit that they found it mm-hmm. first. They found it first. And especially your spouse, there's a lot of fighting between spouses when one finds health and the other one doesn't. It's very difficult. So you have to find as a solution, you have to mm-hmm. find a way to show it to people so that they can think that they found it. It's kind of devious. It might be devious, but good spouses have always been this way, that they'll somehow drop something in front of their spouse and let them pick it up, and then they'll pretend that it's new, and then they'll let the spouse tell them about it, and they'll kind of subvert their own ego then and let the spouse say that they mm-hmm. discovered it in order that the good thing can actually happen. It's very difficult. You're right. That's a huge block.
Well, yeah, because the ego too, right? We don't want to be wrong. We don't want to be embarrassed. Yeah. And then we, of course, want to take the credit for turning somebody around.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow. I had never heard this before, and that's really helpful.
Anyway, that's rough.
Thank you.
Very rough. But good teachers are always like that, that they can see. If I just tell you what to do, you're not going to do it as well as if I can somehow cause you to find the answer. As a teacher, I've always been, the kids will always laugh and go, no, and then they'll tell me the right answer. And I'll go, really?
Mm.
You know, that's the best teacher because they found it.
Mm.
Anyway, so yeah, that's the first block. So how many other blocks are there? That's a huge block.
That's a huge one.
Then the taste. A lot of people think, well, there's no taste in this other food. I get this food because it's good. Like Doritos are great, and I love my Coca-Cola. And
I do love my Coca-Cola. Well, not me. I stopped drinking it a few years ago, but I mean, I still remember like that good pain that gobbling it down.
Yeah,
felt like. Yeah.
I never quite had that myself, but I guess I was poisoned by science. Long ago, they put Coca-Cola and a hamburger in the same glass container.
Mm-hmm.
And then mm-hmm. I looked at it a couple hours later. That was supposed to be what was in my belly without my belly's activity. But
mm-hmm.
anyway.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, a person could argue with you and say, the difference between your mom's cooking and yours, or the time period, was we didn't know it was bad. It was bad, just the same bad then as now.
But it wasn't bad.
Okay.
It wasn't high fructose corn syrup.
Okay.
It wasn't GMO.
Okay.
It wasn't Roundup sprayed.
Yeah, that's.
And it wasn't shipped all the way from Chile. So,
but Wonder Bread was before you.
Right, and listen.
Wonder Bread was.
Pardon?
Wonder Bread was certainly before you, or and Miracle.
Yeah, Wonder Bread was around.
Miracle Whip, so, Wonder Bread, all these modern inventions, food inventions.
Yeah, that's true.
But solutions again anyway. With food. So.
And not just food. You know, I'm a farmer. I think by chance or by providence, maybe, but it's not my life's work. Really, as much as like, what happens to people when we're, you know, what we talked about at the beginning, what happens to us when we're outside, we're happy, we work together, we find bonds with others.
Right.
You know, people that I've worked outside with. And and even very, very uncomfortable, terrible situations. There were a couple summers here where it was 110 degrees for 6 weeks straight and didn't rain. And, you know, like, I don't know what kept this going. But the people that I worked with through that, you know, I can still see them, and very occasionally, but it's like we never left each other. You know, some tightness grew. You could count on them, and, you know, we've seen the bear. We've seen the bareness of ourselves, or we've shared the bareness of ourselves out there.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, when it's so hot that you can't even imagine, like, having any kind of tact into what you're saying, and, you know, not taking any offense, because you don't have any extra energy to take offense at what anybody has said. So, yeah, just, I don't know. It's pretty sweet.
In my
form, so now I...
Oh, go ahead, please, if you're
please,
going on.
No, please.
Are you sure?
I want to listen.
I want to mention this idea that I think is common now, but community-supported agriculture was just starting when I was in my 20s. And I was on one of the very first ones. And that's a healing in another way. Of course, there's the good food. Each member of the farm pays up front for their food. They pay before the harvest. They pay before the planting. Mm-hmm. And so then the farmer is relieved from the worry of bankruptcy. If there's a drought, everybody pays, not just the poor farmer. Everybody pays. You don't just turn your attention to some other farm that has better crops. You suffer with the farmer, and you then come together on the Saturday and do a little bit of harvesting with the farmers, and the farm will have goats and have cows in order that the children will want to come. The children will beg the parents to come, and all these little things come around the center, the farm, and the farmers themselves may actually even change over time, but the farm is a healing, it's a healing thing. Solutionary. The farm is solutionary. So now, if you can remember what you were going to say, I'd love to hear it.
Oh, well, I will, just because it's all connected.
Good.
So now I am not doing farming as my primary job, but I am teaching 16 new immigrant refugees how to do their... run their own farm business. So they each have a quarter acre plot for 4 years, and
lovely.
I guide them through this process.
Lovely.
So CSA is one of the concepts that they are finding out about or are working on. Some of them have multiple CSA, and I would say a handful of them have developed relationships with their CSA members. And it's one of the things that I believe that we really do have to hold on to, because as money, people are noticing, oh, there's money in this organic food, oh, there's money in this concept CSA, that it gets watered down. And it's one of the things that, you know, I work on daily too. Exactly the way you described it is, you know, understanding that the farm itself has value beyond the food that is grown there. It's a place to go. It's a place where suffering and joy are shared, and it's a center. It's a healing place. So, yeah, so I've written those things down. So, so in thinking about CSA with people who have really very little, they don't even have the language that's shared with the rest of us here. I can imagine how healing CSA members, CSA relationship could be with my farmers, with these farmers here.
This idea too, with this idea that you must have seen then with the biodynamics, that the farm is an organism, and it needs animals, and it needs grain to feed the animals, and it needs a water source, and it needs the compost heap. And bees are there because bees are required. And it's just all these things. Instead of our modern idea, which is so dead, to have one crop.
Separate.
Miles and miles and miles of one crop. No bee can survive in that kind of landscape. There's a bee cannot be expected to survive when there's only blossoms for 1 or 2 weeks a year. There's no way to have any group of insects surviving there. Anyway, this CSA often has a biodynamic component of the farm as an organism, and we need to feed all the parts. You need the manure, you need the local manure, you need the et cetera, et cetera.
And the hopes and dreams and pains and aches of every person there who feed the farm as well. So easy. Other things are so fancy and shiny. The desire to make money, the desire to move it along a little more quickly, the desire to spruce it up. I guess that's where I think I have many things figured out, but that's one that's very elusive to me. Is like, why is this money thing? First of all, many different ways to feel about it. So it's elusive, the idea of gathering money, but then almost not good to talk about. It's not good to talk about not having enough. It's shameful, right, to not have enough. So if you would even think about saying that to anybody, you definitely have to hide that so you don't have enough. And then oftentimes it's the farmer who, I mean, how you look at it. So the farmer really has this beautiful healing place and is watching, helping, I don't know, stepping away from letting all these things happen and bringing and facilitating all these relationships. What a powerful, beautiful person. It's almost like the grasshopper and the ants that, if the farmer knew, the farmers I work with, if they knew what they're holding and how much everybody else needed the good food that they're growing, they would not be the refugees that are penniless and willing to give away their produce just to...
Yeah, that's...
For nothing, really.
It's such a paradox. So if you would think, who in my culture, who in my city would be most likely to want to help me with all their heart and soul? John Steinbeck said long ago in this Grapes of Wrath great book, if you need help, go to the poor. They're the only ones who will ever help you. There's this weird paradox of people who don't have the riches, they're actually the wealthiest people. There's this very strange paradox of wealth and money, and they're not at all the same. The people who are truly wealthy usually do not have very much money. It's very strange, very strange. I'm talking on a global scale, not simply in our country.
I'm with you.
If you were going to look for the holiest human on earth, you would go to a poor country. You probably wouldn't even look in the United States. You'd say, oh, it can't be there. I'm looking for a holy person. I'm not looking for an American. No.
No.
It's crazy. So, yeah, how do we let them know? Maybe we shouldn't let them know. People who know that they are wealthy might not be as wealthy then. They've learned. They've been corrupted somehow. I don't know. I totally understand what you're saying, though. I feel that, too. The refugees, I was going to ask, the refugees, they can't be brand new refugees here just off the boat because they're already able to clothe themselves and they have a place to sleep and a place to eat and they know how to shop for food. So they must have been here a while already then.
A short time. Some of them, 7 or 8 years, but some of them, just a couple of years. My organization, Cultivate KC, we collaborate with Catholic Charities of Northeast Kansas, and it's their job. It's Catholic Charities, one of their missions to help refugees get settled in and find a home and make a home. And so that's the way the two organizations came together. But I believe that they must do a good job in helping folks get settled. And then, this is interesting too. Different people's points of view have your. I'm so grateful for this time because not often do we take time just to have conversations. And to share beautiful ideas. So I was sharing with my boss this notion that so here I'm standing on 10 acres that's in the middle of the oldest and the biggest federal housing projects in the state of Kansas. So that's the home of our garden. That's the setting. It's 10 acres in the middle of this housing project. And I'm working with refugees, so mostly from Southeast Asia and a couple from Nepal, Bhutan. So I'm working with refugees. And we know, even without knowing the stories, what kind of pain comes from or they've seen in their life. And So thinking about standing there, thinking about all the pain that the refugees have seen, but to stand in the garden and to look around the garden, there's none of that at all. There's none. I mean, pain is the last thing that you feel when your heart is lifted up and the sun is shining and you see hope all around. You see young kids running and laughing and playing and throwing rocks and, you know.
Yeah.
And you see people who don't have the same language at all. And actually, even people of cultures who one was the oppressor and one was the oppressed back in Burma,
yeah.
If not become best friends, at least work together in the same small space.
Yeah.
So that's almost impossible. Another paradox. So I was telling this story to my boss, who is a beautiful, smart, but very pragmatic person. And she said, well, really, it shouldn't surprise you at all, because the folks who are here, the refugees who have made it here, are the survivors. They're the ones who somehow have figured out the way to make it through, the way to make it happen,
yeah.
The hope, you know, through the darkness.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
It's so healing to hear of this. I mean, why else do we read great literature, the Russian novels and such? I get a real strength from seeing how bad it can get. And just having these refugees in our presence is so good for us, who never have any trouble. We never have any trouble compared to them. It's so good for us. So good for us to be near them.
Mm-hmm.
I always go to this image of some poor fellow in some German camp during World War II, and people were dying, and all they had to eat was trash, you know, and the trash they're eating is no good. Back to food again.
Mm-hmm.
The survivor will chew in a way loving. What kind of foods do we just chew and chew? We love that kind of food. We want to savor that food the most. We don't gobble. When we love our food, we take our time. Anyway, the survivors take their time. And so they somehow give nourishment, or they take nourishment from the things that have no nourishment, an old leather boot or something. You can actually get life-giving forces out of it if you take your time. And so the survivor mentality of cherishing even this horrible thing, you're cherishing life, you want to live and you're savoring it. There's so many great pictures, but that's the one I always turn to as when you're in this horrible place that you somehow have to find the nourishment from yourself. You have to say, this is the world too. This is the beautiful world too. I'm alive. Mm-hmm. I'm alive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But being around a refugee, I think that's marvelous. Again, the solutionary. You see, if they can do it, I can do it. If another man can do it, I can do it.
Yeah. Also, how little they waste and how.
Oh, yeah.
And how humble we are, and it's not even a care. Like, I don't care if I get this out of the trash can. Like, I can't believe someone would even have the guts to throw this in the trash can anyway.
Right,
like, why would they even? Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally good.
Yeah.
It just happened last week. Yeah. So that's a good lesson for me. You know, it's a good lesson for me. I've learned. So, yeah, I learned so much from them, even though I'm supposed to be the teacher.
Yeah.
It hit me sometime last year. So I've just been doing this for a year. I ran a production farm for a number of years, so I'm working on my soft edges now again, which I'm really happy about. But I realized just a month into this job that the interpreters aren't there for the farmers. The interpreters are there for me.
Yeah,
you know, I'm the one who only speaks English and who can pay attention to interpreters. Yeah.
And you're the one that needs to hear from them. You need to hear what they're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Now I want to know what you meant by working on your soft edges. That's a nice phrase, but I don't know what that means.
So I come from a biodynamic farm, right, where it was about art and the spirit of agriculture.
Yeah.
And that's home. You know, that feels like home for me and almost easy. It's easy. So coming to Kansas City and running a production farm, I learned a lot. It was a big learning curve, but I learned a lot, you know, and valuable, very valuable information, how to really push the limits of time and space and energy, you know, like on a human level and on a soil level, on every level, and really squeeze out as much food as possible because we grew on an acre. And we grow an incredible amount of food on an acre. And the point is that we could show other people that we could do it. That's the goal of doing it on this farm, to show that it's possible to grow a bunch of food on 1 acre.
Right.
But what happened to my soft sides is that they were sanded down pretty, you know, and to be pretty hard. And was on my shoulders to make sure all this got done, make sure people got in line and got the stuff done and, you know, put things away. And so a harder side of me was present for a long time. So to just take that weight off my shoulders and to find the middle, you know, to come back a bit and find the middle, because the lessons that I learned, super valuable. I'm, you know, running a budget. I had never kept track of money in any kind of good way before, or production planning, knowing when we were going to plant and keeping track and running spreadsheets and all that stuff. Really good technical information, but not really what I enjoy so much.
Yeah.
So now I'm thinking, like, I do enjoy it because I'm not afraid of it any longer. So, like, to take that away.
That's lovely. Yeah. Lovely.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
You just made me think of this.
And being...
Go ahead. I didn't... You're still talking.
No, I want to hear. Yes. No, I'm good.
You know, you're being...
We'll come back to it.
Okay, maybe. If you remember. So you made me think of this beautiful art project someone did. I think it was in Manhattan, where a guy would set up a camera, and then he'd grab this person and that person who never met. And he'd, okay, would you mind posing for me? And they pose as though they're lovers, or as though they're mom and dad, or mom and child. And in 10 minutes or less, the people are in love with each other. They actually fall in love. And it's because of the proximity and the looking into each other's eyes. And you made me think of that with this farming as well, with the refugee and being in close proximity, and even without the language. But then this conversation thing too, I don't know you at all, and yet I'm kind of falling in love with you. It's really so lovely. I'm very happy to have time with you. Thank you, Alicia.
It's very, it's very sweet, Jack. Thank you.
No.
It's a beautiful thing to be able to open up and just talk freely and fly away with words. Yeah. Thank you.
To see what comes up really tells who a person is, what comes up.
And how good you are at your work.
Or whatever,
No,
I don't know if you'll remember what you were going to say.
I don't know that I do either.
Okay, that's okay. I'm sorry. You were too nice to let
me. No, it is okay.
Are you
kidding me? You are apologizing to a person for saying you're falling in love with them?
No, I'm saying...
That's a beautiful thing.
I was apologizing that you were so nice to always let me go on with what I was going to say, that I think you lost a couple of things you were going to say. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they circle back around. This thing about really that is all... That's all there is really to do, is find that we love each other.
Yeah.
That we can be kind and gentle with each other.
I don't know if you've thought of that much. I've been a romantic all my life, and I've really been trying to fall in love at first sight as much as possible. Now that I'm in my 50s, and there's less social repulsion from that kind of thing. When you get older, especially an older guy, he can flirt, he can... Mm-hmm. All kinds of stuff. I'm much more free now to say too to people, I love you. It's really nice, and I'm not going to miss my chance to tell as many people as possible. I don't know that it's why is it not that way with young people? When you see young people, they have such trouble saying what they feel. They want to wear dark clothes. They cross their arms over their chest. Somehow, as we get older, we open up and we're much more able to say what we feel. It's so wonderful to be older. I'm really happy to be this age. It's really lovely.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It is, a lot of it is nice.
Yep.
Being older. I think maybe it's some to do with that we realize our mortality, and when we're 20, it's not even on our mind. We don't feel like there's any kind of need to hurry up and...
Right. Getting rid of the superfluous, the jealousies and the greeds and the...
Yeah, the expectation that goes around it.
I'm hoping young people... You have kids. I'm glad. I don't have kids. But to have kids who can see an adult who is happy. How many adults are just miserable having facelifts and dating someone a third their age? They're not gracefully going into old age. They're struggling against it. I think that's sad. I think a young person should see, no, it's okay. It's really cool. I hope I get to be that old. That'll be great. I hope more people are like that.
My daughter's really helped me become a better person, a kinder person.
How old is she?
She's 13. She's 13.
What a great age. I've known some 13-year-olds that suddenly they can't get them away from the mirror. They're just so in love with themselves in the mirror. It's really amazing. I guess I was that way too. That we're so amazed at ourselves. Look at me. You just look at
me. Yeah.
I don't know if
Look at me. I'm changing every day.
Yeah.
I don't even know what I can say. If I say anything about her, it's not going to be enough. No, it's just not going to be enough.
That's right.
Lovely thing, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. This is beautiful.
Yeah, it was definitely my pleasure.
And
happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah,
happy Valentine's Day.
Happy
day of love, celebrating love this world.
That's right.
Well, that was great. That was so great. Thanks, Alicia. Very nice to meet you. And thank you all for listening. Do it again next week if you could. Leave me a message if you like at reasoningwithanoptimist.net. This is Jack Brissett Mills. Bye-bye.